people know in advance what they're supposed to do. So let me give you an example. There's this thing called the teachable moment. We're all aware of what that means. When somebody is hit or killed in a neighborhood or community, there's a heightened sense of awareness, concern, interest in the issue. People really want to know more. They want to hear more. They perhaps want to know, what can we do in the future to make sure this doesn't happen again? And so at that moment, if you're prepared with your message to come forward and talk about what we can do, what we should be doing, if you're prepared, then you can seize that teachable moment and really initiate and get people to act and change. So that's the preparation part. That's the doing it in advance part. So it's not reactive, so that it happens and then we're like, oh my gosh, what do we do? What do we say? How do we, you know, talk with our school board or the public or the media, whoever it is we're talking to? You have to have that message done in advance. So that's what our program's all about, is moving norm change along and then also teaching people how to use that that instant moment when folks are ready to hear the message. We do a lot of things throughout the state to do this. This is how we do it. We do kind of regionalized trainings, county level, city level, and this is how we teach the model. The norm change piece is a media campaign. I shouldn't really call it a media campaign. It's at this point sort of a print campaign called It's Up to All of Us. And It's Up to All of Us is a bunch of templates, artwork templates that are on our website that people can download. We don't pay to have stuff printed at this point, although this coming year we're probably going to have enough money to do some billboards and some other things. But at this point, it's up to an organization to download the materials and turn it into what they wanted. Police departments have been putting it on the back of their citations to drunk drivers or to people they've been stopping in DUIs. We've had people, law enforcement, put up posters in Starbucks. I mean, it really depends on what the community wants to do. And the templates can all be tailored with individual messages that are specific to the problems of that neighborhood. So, you know, I need to give this background because this is kind of important for our nation in that, you know, in 1994, we had about 15 to 20% of the country as overweight or obese. So in 2010, and you've heard all this, I'm sure, we've leapt to over 30%, going quickly towards 40% of our country being overweight or obese. And so with these growing trends, particularly among our youth and our children, we need to get people out walking. But in order to do that, we need to make sure it's also safe. So that's really why this program is so important. The rates of overweight and obese children has tripled amongst 12 to 19-year-olds and quadrupled amongst 6 to 11-year-olds in the last 3 decades. So we really want to get kids active. The majority of kids in 1974, about 66% of kids walked or biked to school. Now we're down to about, in 2009, only about 13%. There's issues of safety, you know, parents, you know, with stranger danger, you probably heard of that, where, you know, we're afraid the kids are going to get swiped on their way to school or they're going to get hit by a car or whatever. So there's that concern. Sometimes there's just not physically safe routes for kids to walk. So there's lots of reasons. And then we've built, in the 1980s, we built all these suburbs where basically by the way the crow flies, it's maybe a quarter mile to get from your house to the school, but the way the roads are set up, you have to walk out this way, then around here, and pretty soon you've got a two-mile walk that really should have only been a quarter mile. So we've built these massive suburbs where the schools aren't even in the areas where the people are living. They're like on the outside. So all those have led to reasons why we really want kids and adults out walking. I think, important things to keep in mind in terms of pedestrian collisions. The faster a car is going, the more likely it is going to kill you. So if a car hits you at 20 miles an hour, you only have about a 5% chance of being killed by that car, a 65% chance of being injured. Now, jump that up 10 miles per hour. So if a car is now going 30 miles an hour, you have a 45% chance of being killed by that car, 50% chance of being injured. If the car is going 40, so really 20 to 40, that's not like a huge jump, you are now 85% at risk for being killed. And the injured part, there isn't even an uninjured category in there at all. It's basically if you're hit by a 40 mile per hour car, you're either dead or you're severely injured. So the speed is really important, and it doesn't take that much. It's not, you know, like freeway speeds at all by any chance. A couple of factors that really come into play: time of day, time of year, and time of the week. So these are other things, if you're a pedestrian, keep in mind. First of all, time of the year, winter months. Much more likely to get hit by a car in the winter months. We think that's an issue of lack of daylight. So that's mostly what that is. Time of the week, as you might guess, it's weekends, particularly Friday and Saturday. More people are out and about, socializing, having fun. There's just more recreation on the weekends. Time of day, this I think is really important because it's an easy one to think about. 4 p.m. to 8 p.m., it spikes. It really spikes. And that's a combination of people getting off of work, getting off of school, and then changes in daylight. So these are just things to keep in mind when you're trying to make decisions about when you're going to get out on the road. Okay, now I want to do some discussion. So we have a choice here. We can either sit in the seats where we are now and just kind of try and have an open forum in this room, or if people are willing, we can kind of shift around a little bit and get into more of a group setting. What do you folks prefer? Open forum? Okay. All right, so I'm hearing a majority open forum. Okay, so I'm going to throw out a fact that I did a little research on, and then I want you guys to tell me kind of the answers to some of these questions, what your thoughts are. So based on population estimates, the average legally blind person is less likely to be killed or hospitalized as a result of being hit by a car than the average sighted individual. Okay, I'm going to read that one more time. Based on population estimates, so the number of people, the average legally blind person is less likely to be killed or hospitalized as a result of being hit by a car than the average sighted individual. So part of this is just there's a lot less sight-impaired people out on the road. But here's my question to you. Is this because the visually impaired are less likely to walk due to safety concerns, or are there other reasons? Yes.
If our volunteer could help us get a mic around.
We had a wireless at one point.
There's supposed to be, Donna, do you have a wireless mic?
Can you guys hear her?
I think that it's, I am. I think that part of the problem is the total visibility. I think as blind people, we don't realize that when I'm wearing dark clothes, I'm also erasing myself from the sighted public. I'm used to the blind world where color isn't a matter. So one of the things that I do is I always make sure that at least part of my clothing is light colored. And if I can, I use an exterior light and carry it with me to get attention.
Okay. All right, someone else had their hand up in the back there? Two people.
Holly, excuse me, a clarification. Are you saying that people with visual impairments are, in fact, less likely to be hit? They're asking whether they're less likely to be hit.
They are less...
Well, let me propose, with all due respect, that the statistic is invalid and creates a misimpression. First of all, again, there is the possibility of less exposure. It's the same question as who are more likely to have car accidents, people over 90 or people between 40 and 50. And unless you control for miles driven, you have no meaningful way of answering that question. But to the extent that the raw data, I assume, does not take into account such factors as age, as physical condition, and so forth, it creates probably a misleading impression of relative safety that empirical evidence and indeed the experience of everyone here does not support. It's an example of statisticalizing and therefore making obscure and abstract something which is really a matter of common sense.
So in your opinion, I think that's an excellent observation, an important observation. keep a sight impaired person. Sorry. Okay, wait. They're switching out microphones on me. From feeling safe or from venturing out and walking.
Everyone here in their own experience could list a number of self-evident factors that are involved, ranging from the inability of drivers to see them or the unawareness of drivers of the fact that we have laws in traffic codes, so-called white cane laws, and what they require of driver attention to traffic lights, which are neither non-existent or not well calibrated or not well located, to crosswalks that are not well located, to so-called blind curves and blind turns, no pun intended, to unenforcement of the speed limits, to the failure of prosecutors to take seriously cases of accident and injury involving arguable criminal negligence on the part of drivers. The factors go on and on and on, and everyone in this room could identify a number of factors. We tend to respond as a community, I think, naturally by, in the first instance, looking to ourselves, looking to choices we make about clothing, of time of day, of route, etc. And these are all relevant factors. We all have to take some responsibility, but the structural dynamics of the current traffic situation and the country's obsession with the automobile and with vehicular movement as the prime goal of government and social life is really the problem.
Okay. Can you guys hear me? Is this on? Okay. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Okay. So why don't those are extremely astute observations. We had two other hands up. Let's hear from a couple other folks. This gentleman here in the...
We can get the mic to them.
Yes, I agree completely with what Mr. Mendelson just said regarding the questions regarding the statistics that we're talking about here. So I won't repeat that, but I think that assuming that to the extent that a sound statistical analysis could identify a lower rate of injury for blind pedestrians as opposed to sighted pedestrians, two things might be in play. First of all, the truth of the matter is that the average blind pedestrian is probably better trained as a pedestrian than the average sighted pedestrian.
That's true.
Most obviously, if we blind pedestrians have noticed that if we try to get directions from sighted pedestrians, that they are at a complete loss to give simple directions that we blind people would understand perfectly because of our training. So there may be a lot of sighted people making very stupid decisions about street crossing that we wouldn't make. But the second concern there, though, which is, I think, is the key to everything we're talking about today, when we eliminate statistical anomalies, is that we need to address the extent to which prevailing traffic and pedestrian conditions discourage the mobility and therefore the freedom of blind pedestrians.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to comment on what you said about you're better trained as pedestrians. That might be a hook for a message. We're going to do a little message development in a little bit, and that actually might be a clever way of sort of framing the issue from a message perspective. So let's hold on to that, because I think that's... It's got some humor, but it's also, it's kind of an eye-opener, I think, for the driver and perhaps the irresponsible pedestrian, too. Okay.
Another person, then I'd like to make a comment.
Okay. That's you. And then this.
There was another person?
Yes, well, I think by virtue of the fact that one can't see makes you more defensive, makes you more cautious, and that may affect the statistics.
Good point. Okay. Jean, and then we have a lady in the back.
There's two points. One is that the numbers out there, there is research. Janet Barlow and BZ Benson have done research on whether it makes differences with the aging population. It was in the Journal of Visual Impairment 10, 15 years ago, and it found that people if you're outside the urban area, you have very few sidewalks, and that's a disincentive of people getting out there and traveling, and that is something when you look overall, that that is a discouragement, and that is where it gets to, and this is a very unpopular thing to say, but it's some of the realities. The sidewalk, lack of sidewalks, and the complexity, the more complex and challenging the intersections are, that it can be a disincentive without updated training, is people are using paratransit so they can get more of the door-to-door service. It's not a convenience. It's more that they're trying to avoid these hazards, so they're maybe less exposed out in there in the street. And that may be another factor contributing to the lower number there. But there is data that shows if you don't have sidewalks that get you to the bus stop or to the intersections, you're less likely to venture out on your own.
And that's true for the sighted population, too. I mean, we do a lot around safe routes to school. And, you know, the biggest thing in the urban area is you have kids walking along the side of a road, you know, three deep, right into the path of where the cars are driving. So it's, in terms of the rural parts of California, it's a real issue, the lack of sidewalks for transportation. Okay, and the lady in the back?
Yes, I'm Margaret from Merced. I'd just like to add, I think education is a very big piece of this. I'm kind of aging myself, but when I remember growing up in the schools, there was a lot done as part of the curriculum on how to be a pedestrian, you know, walking against traffic, crossing at crosswalks, not jaywalking. There was a big emphasis on that type of thing. And I think it's probably because we had one car, Dad drove it to work, and the only way we could get to the store or anything else was to walk. And so I think a piece of that is the education, and I really like the idea of educating people more. An example just being, my daughter lives in San Francisco, and she talks it all the time when she drives, people jaywalk all over the place. And those are not your sight-impaired people, because sight-impaired people normally don't jaywalk. They look for where there's a safe crossing. So when you talk about the statistics, that probably plays into the factor. The training is a piece of it. I know I've crossed a street, and my daughter will go, oh, it's green, let's go. And I can hear that car that's going to run the red light, you know, because I'm paying attention to not a light change, but to the traffic. So part of it is our training that somebody brought up already, too. But I think a big piece of it is educating the public, educating that starts young in the schools of how to be a pedestrian and a safe pedestrian, and also working on the barriers that exist as far as, I live in a rural area, a semi-rural town, and I just had an incident the other day. There's no crosswalk painted on the ground on a very major street to cross from one corner to the other. You know, those kinds of things just shouldn't even be allowed to exist in any kind of a size of a town.
She stepped away for just a minute. She's running back. Lickety split.
So, I have a question I'd like to ask. In high school and driver education, don't they automatically include a section on dealing with the disabled and what to watch for, the signs, et cetera, for pedestrians?
That's a good question. I don't believe so. My daughter just went through driver's ed. She didn't mention anything about that. Yeah, no, she did it online. I know.
Well, but they still have to take a test, don't they?
Pardon?
They have to take a driver's test. I would think perhaps working toward making sure or requiring by law, if necessary, that be included in the class curriculum.
Well, maybe that could be a goal of this group, is to work with DMV to, you know, make sure and get it. Go ahead.
DMV has usually one question on all the on the exams that has to do in general terms about disability pedestrians. It is not something extensive. We have gotten into the handbook for drivers some information, and it can't be extremely lengthy, that guide, but we do have language under pedestrians, and you can get that on the DMV's website, the information.
And I liked your comment. Is it Margaret? I liked your comment, Margaret, because I remember that too. I remember being in school and learning, you know, you look both ways. I mean, there was very specific instruction for children, And that went away. It kind of doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, it's hit or miss with safe routes to school. If a school has safe routes, then kids are learning a lot. If there is no safe routes, it's not part of really the education. And it's interesting because the dangers are so much more so than they were 30 years ago, 40 and 50 years ago. So it's interesting that that kind of went away. One can just probably guess competing funds and resources in education. However, part of what this group's responsibility is this morning is to take on that education piece. And that was actually one of my questions to you, was what are the potential education-based solutions? Do you folks, at this point, we haven't, you know, gone into a lot of discussion yet this morning, but at this point, are there ideas that you guys have thought about? A couple hands.
This is Charlene Ornelas. I'm with the San Diego Braille Club. And I think one of them is to get to the broadcasting companies, especially the TV, and discuss this and get it out over the airwaves and make people aware of it. And sometimes, a while back, several years ago, one of the stations actually showed crossing a street without any vision. They had it all dark.
Oh, wow.
And found out what it was like. So, but that's a real good one, is to go to your public media and newspapers, radio stations, TV, and try to get in the eye of the public.
Okay, good. Next.
Thanks. Hi, good morning. This is Teddy Joy Rimhild from Burbank. And I've been working with my city council, my city public works department, for the last a few years, trying to get accessible pedestrian signals. I finally made a connection. I think going to your city council is really important. They want to be reelected. You know, I think it's really important to have your issues, publicly conveyed. And so if you can do public comment or something like that at a city council meeting. But I've been emailing everybody in the city of Burbank about pedestrian signals, and I'm finally making some progress. Gene helped me a lot, putting me in touch with the vendor who I then put in touch with the public works guy. But it takes a lot of time. It doesn't happen. You're working with government, but if you keep at it, it won't happen at all. So I'm sort of a relentless kind of person, so it's finally happening in Burbank.
Wow, kudos to you, because that does take a lot of dedication, and getting things changed in the transportation field is never, you know, an overnight process. So, you know, I totally, you know, I pat you on the back, and I, you know, encourage anyone in this room to really take that to heart, that you do have to keep at it. But then, you know, there's some real change that can happen too, so it's worth it. So thanks for your efforts. Anyone else have thoughts, just, you know, at the start here, in terms of educational endeavors?
A couple of things. I've never been entirely sure where education ends and coercion begins. But leaving aside that not so bright line, I would suggest that prosecutors need to be encouraged, need to be demanded of, that in cases where injury occurs to disabled and particularly to blind pedestrians, under circumstances which are in violation of the white cane law, as it exists in almost every state, that prosecution be undertaken vigorously. There are almost no prosecutions now ever, and it's basically considered fair game. And the attitude of police and prosecutors around the country is basically that if they were foolish enough to be out on the street on their own, they deserve what they get. And that has to change. Yeah. And there are ways of leveraging prosecutors and police as well. Second of all, I wonder about the insurance industry. And I wonder if there's any outreaches have been made or could be made to the insurance industry regarding the expectations. I wonder if, for example, the people who have accidents involving collisions with pedestrians with disabilities incur any additional increase in their premiums beyond those of ordinary accidents, whether they should, whether they could, things of that nature. I also wonder about the road design and the road maintenance processes that go on in various city and states. And Gene, of course, is more knowledgeable than any of us here and has spent a career doing heroic service in trying to find ways to intervene in those processes at early enough points so that design decisions can be made to enhance safety to the degree that possible. So that would be an area for working in as well.
Wow, those are some really creative, some out-of-the-box thinking, and that's the kind of thing that can really be effective. Okay.
I have a question on the research. Has any been done in relationship to accidents involving blind or low-vision people as to why the accident occurred? Have they been able to pinpoint, is it just a careless driver, or was it an action that the disabled person took that caused or created the scenario for the accident? And I think Mr. Mendelson's comments are very, very well taken, but I seriously question whether or not the legal profession is going to pay any attention at all to simple accidents. They're so overburdened with other legal considerations that they deem to be much more important in terms of crime. Education should be number one, and incorporating it into driver training schools or into the public school. I don't know, do they still teach health classes? Whatever class would be appropriate, they could certainly work in a couple of days on simple common sense behavior toward their driving or their walking habits.
Regarding the statistics, I did such a brief search that I think Gene might have, do you have more information, Gene?
A little bit.
Okay, microphone's coming. I hate to move this microphone because it's sensitive. Yeah,
thank you, Holly. Unfortunately, and this has been discussed on the national level with the American Council of the Blind, Environmental Access Committee, as well as this group, and there's a group that Holly's involved with, CalPED. There is almost no statistics on pedestrian conflicts with motorists or bicyclists. It is, unless there happens to be a police officer and does a report. The groups, CalWalks and other groups, and as well as state agencies, have worked with the Highway Patrol to modify a form they use. It's 55.
Yeah, 555.
Yeah, I'll let you talk more about that. But that is one way of starting to get data. So, no, there is almost no data on what happens to pedestrians, even without disabilities. And I'll let Holly talk more about that form.
Yeah, I think it's an important point to understand where the data comes from, because we get it about 18 months to 24 months late. All the data the majority of the data comes from what's called SWTRS, which is the Statewide Integrated Traffic Record System. And it is populated by the completion of Form 555. So basically, CHP, and it's not mandated that local law enforcement use it, but a lot of them do. When there's an accident, we don't call them accidents, we call them collisions and crashes. When there's a collision, they fill out this Form 555. And so, you know, whatever information is put into the SWTRS database comes from that form. But by the time all that information is uploaded and then translated, it really is about 18 months before we actually get the data. And then it's limited to what's on the form. So one thing that our Caltrans and there's the Strategic Highway Safety Plan, and that's sort of the oversight of all transportation issues in the state in terms of sort of research and planning. And Challenge Area 8 is the one that's all about pedestrians and walking. So that's the one I'm on. And we probably have a list of at least a dozen questions or items we'd like to get added to Form 555. But we're just one group. So you can imagine the speeding folks, the DUI folks, everybody has all these issues that'd like to get added to Form 555. And it's a very involved process to change the form. So I guess all of this is the long way of saying the data does have its limitations. And so that's why in our community, in our neighborhood, if we have local police department data, local crash data, or if we have anecdotal data just from observational information as being a neighborhood person, that's valuable, and we should pay attention to that, because sometimes that's more accurate and all we have to go on. So you know, keep your eyes peeled. Okay, so we've got some good ideas. I'm going to move on just a little bit here because I want a few guys to understand a few other concepts before we do some actual messaging activities. I talked a little bit about the teachable moment. I just want you to understand that it's using that teachable moment is what brings us the longer term change. Okay, and later on we're going to look at a scenario of a blind person who was hit and killed in Richmond, Virginia in August. I tried to find something local here in California. Again, I was my search ability was a little limited. But it doesn't really matter where it happened because we want to take apart that incident and learn about what messages could have been prepared in advance to really make the communication with the media, with the public, with the community more effective. So we're going to actually take apart sort of a scenario in a little bit. I want to also to understand about the workbook because I want you to know that what is going on is that when we do these trainings, we are working with just about everybody who works in pedestrian safety, whether it's law enforcement, education, transportation, planners, school people, public health people. We really try, the more diverse the audience is when we do these trainings, the better. And so it goes for the same with you folks developing messages that are either targeting drivers or targeting your community, whatever it is, the more angles of people you involve, the more comprehensive you make that involvement, the more likely your messages are going to be successful. Now, so just to make sure you guys understand what we're talking about, we talk about norm change. So many of you probably remember 30 years ago, you walked into a restaurant, less than 20 years ago, you walked into a restaurant and the hostess would say, would you like smoking or non-smoking section? Okay, y'all remember that? Yeah, okay. So like the smoke knew which was the smoking section and which was the non-smoking section, right? So, you know, with great funding from the tobacco tax, we were able to launch Proposition 99 and really make a change in the state of California. In fact, we were the leader in the world. In terms of smoke-free laws. Now you can't smoke in work sites. A lot of the hotels in the state are now smoke-free. Bars are smoke-free. They're even now working on smoke-free beaches, which is, you know, pretty advanced work. But it was changing the norm. So it used to be that the norm was the smoker could light up wherever they wanted, including on an airplane. Can you imagine that now, sitting on an airplane next to a smoker? It's hard for me to even imagine it anymore. And so that was the norm. And then we gradually started, you know, through educating people about the dangers of secondhand smoke. So yeah, whether you chose to smoke or not was your decision. But me as a non-smoker, I had the right to keep my lungs healthy. So, you know, how do I protect my rights? And so through that education process, suddenly the non-smoker, that became the norm. And so pedestrian safety, again, that's the norm we want to change. We want to get it so that the pedestrian is seen as that equal partner on the road. So I kind of want to make that analysis. And then in terms of transportation safety, a few campaigns have been successful in terms of norm changes, the clicker ticket. So like you get into a car and I get in the car and before I even start the car, my seatbelt on. I mean, it's like, I don't even think about it anymore. Whereas back, you know, when I was a kid, we were running around in the back seat, like, you know, little squirrels. We didn't, you know, no one wore a seatbelt. We'd be in the back of those old station wagons, you know, just like playing games and stuff. It was like a big party. Maybe it was more fun back then, but it certainly wasn't as safe. So the clicker ticket, that's another campaign that's kind of been really successful in changing the norms. I mean, if someone's not wearing a seatbelt, it's not just, an issue of getting a ticket. It's also like, wow, you're kind of not really smart. And then MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, is another really good one. I mean, it used to be, we used to hear about in Sacramento, the double martini lunch or something like that. I guess back in the 60s, a lot of the legislators would go out and I don't know. So, like, that would be the norm. Or, like, when you walked into a party, no one would have a basket there to throw your keys in, you know. Or there wouldn't be advertising from the alcohol industry that said, you know, drink responsibly, you know, get a designated driver. That just wasn't part of it, part of the drinking culture, but now it is. So these are some successful campaigns. I talked a little bit about what risk communication is, so I think you kind of get that. It's just being able to plan in advance. A couple more notes in terms of, a couple of you folks have mentioned the media, and I do want to emphasize the media is our ally. They can be our friend, and we can nurture those relationships so that when something does happen and we want to get our story out there, and a couple of you have mentioned some very, very creative ideas, we're going to be more successful if we kind of can build that relationship and figure out who are, you know, the local reporters that might have an interest in this and who will report responsibly on it. That's all I'm going to say about that. Lots of different media types. I want folks to be aware that really, you know, the traditional press conference, TV ad, those are harder to do now because, you know, it's time is limited. The internet, that's where things are at now. Blogging, websites, downloads, YouTube. So you really want to start thinking a lot more about when you're working with the media about doing more with the internet than traditional media outlets that we used to think about with television and print. Okay, I'm going to shift a little bit to talking about reaching your audience. This is kind of important for you folks, I think, particularly because as I was preparing for this, I thought, so in some communities that we've been working with in our trainings, they would identify folks with disabilities as one of their target populations, one of the populations they want to make sure that stay safe or have special needs, and you know, what is it we need to do to make sure we work with that community, work with their gatekeepers, help develop messages that work for them. But in thinking about this presentation today, it was like, now their target group is actually more like the driver. And so sort of our challenge this morning is to come up with some messages that are pithy, attention getting, send knowledge out about what does a driver need to know to increase their awareness about the challenges you folks face when you're out there walking. So you have a different target audience than what we might traditionally think of as a target audience because it's very broad, but your message is specific. So drivers is a broad group, but the message is much more specific. And in a minute, I'll share with you some of the messages that we developed for the campaign, and you'll see how they're very, very broad. And so what we want to work on this morning is something, is shifting that a little bit. A couple things you need to understand as you're developing messages for your target population, if we decide that's drivers, some things to keep in mind. When you deliver the message is important. So if there's specific geographical places where you feel like, you know, if there's a school for the blind or, you know, certain areas of a community where we want to sort of target those messages, it's, you know, when do we deliver it is kind of tied to not just when there's incident. Like some people get a little bit confused that what I'm talking about is only delivering messages when there's a collision. That's one strategy. The other strategy is sort of the pervasive, ongoing messages to kind of change people's thinking and behavior. How you deliver the message is really important. It's, you know, do you think print will work? You know, some of you guys mentioned, you know, working with the media. So you want to have a variety of ways on how you're going to deliver the message. And then who is going to deliver that message? You know, who's your spokesperson? Who's going to, you know, if you do sit down and maybe do some public television interviews or something, who's the best person to speak to that? This person who mentioned that there was a show where they actually, was it you? Who mentioned this show where they actually kind of walked through? Yeah, like that's really creative. So that's the kind of thinking that we need. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here. Okay, so here's a group exercise I want us to do. We've got about an hour left, and I would really like you guys to walk away with some messaging things. First, before we do that, though, I'm going to just give you an idea of what the current It's Up to All of Us campaign looks like, okay? There's three basic designs. The first one is a series of, and this is going to sound simplistic, but it's actually very eye-catching. There's a series of dots. So when you see a stoplight, you've got I don't know what order they're in, red, green, yellow. I can't think right now what order they're in. So that's kind of what the idea with this artwork was, that it's reminiscent of like a stoplight, but it's much more eye-catching in terms of its color. So you've got neon green, sort of a royal peacock blue, burnt orange, bright pink, yellow, and black. Okay, so you've got a series of these dots, one, two, three, four, five of them, six of them, in a row. Okay, so it's like you see it. You see it right away. And then underneath the dots, we have different bylines. Stay alert, stay alive. And this is a statistic. It's true and extrapolated. Every hour, a pedestrian is killed or injured in California. Yeah. Well, it's if you take the stats and extrapolate it, you could say on average, this is sort of what we call a media framing so that people can digest the number easier. And it's a very common way to share statistics with people who don't, do statistics. And then we have these smaller, so that's in big, kind of big, bold writing. Then in smaller writing, we have these sort of individualized messages like look up, look around, don't assume you're seen, walk safely, your life depends on it. Slow down, look out for others, don't drive distracted. Look both ways before crossing the road, don't assume you're seen. Those are the same. So that's the first piece of artwork. The second is what we call the waves. And the waves, it's sort of a neon-ish green with a teal blue, and they're like these big bold lines. And in the bottom line, it's sort of like a half arch, and it says it won't kill you to drive safely. And that's one of the bylines there. And then under every single one, we always have that statistic, every hour a pedestrian is killed or injured in California. And then we have our final one. So we had two messages to pedestrians, two messages directed to drivers, and then we had a community-wide one. And this came from some work we were doing in a Native American tribe, the La Jolla tribe, not that far from here, the La Jolla tribe of Lisueño Indians, out here on 174, I think it is. Anyway, this 174, I don't know if I have the highway right, it bisects their, what is it?
74?
It bisects their community. So basically people are going from the casinos to the camping area at the other end of this highway. And so people are racing back and forth. Well, it's going right through their community, and they'd had a number of people who'd been hit. And unfortunately, I think 3 weeks after we did the training, a person was actually killed on that road, one of the tribal members. And they basically said, it's so frustrating because people don't realize this is our home. This is where our children play. This is where we walk our dogs. And so we want some signage or some message that it reminds people we live here. Slow down, respect our space. And so we came up with the third campaign, which is it's a green background with two red ruby slippers. And it says, Dorothy had it right. There's no place like home, our home. Make sure you get there. And so the concept, this is more like a yard sign. This isn't something you'd put in a billboard necessarily, but it's like a yard sign or a sign around a park or a school. It's reminding people this is a community where people want to stay safe. So these are the general messages of the It's Up to All of Us campaign. And again, in thinking about your challenge in terms of developing messages, I was thinking you need to hone in and come up with messages specific to the driver about protecting your population. And that's one thought. It sounds like there's a lot of other things, a lot of the great ideas you guys have, but that's my initial sort of out of the gate. Okay, now I'm not going to read all of this to you because you guys already know this stuff and it's too lengthy. But in doing a little bit of research, this is what I learned. The average driver is not aware of what is involved for the vision impaired to cross the street. And then you've got 1, 2, 3, 4 items here. Locating and recognizing the street. You have to use cues, you have to include curb or slope of the ramp, traffic sounds, detectable warnings. You need to probably have a mental map to keep track of where you are within that map, within your head. That may happen by counting blocks or street crossings. The next item is intersection assessment. And these are all the things that average driver has no clue that all this is going on while you're being a pedestrian out there. You're going to be working to obtain critical information about the intersection, crosswalk location, direction to the opposite corner, the number of intersecting streets at that intersection, the width of the street to be crossed, and whether there are any islands or medians in the crosswalk. Okay, that's a lot of information to take in. Type of traffic control. This could be determined by listening to the traffic patterns through a couple light cycles, and then search for the sidewalk area for poles or push buttons. And the last one is crossing the roadway. The most common technique, apparently, they say, is crossing at signalized intersection is to cross when there is a surge of traffic, of through traffic on the closest side of the street parallel to the direction of travel. That in itself, I just read that and I go, wow, that's complicated. And so I really think, this is just my out of the gate. I have not, I've not actually worked on a campaign for the blind before, but I really think if drivers knew these challenges, these steps, this amount of information that has to be gathered and implemented to cross the street, they would have more respect, more concern, and more caution for everybody, really, but particularly for sight impaired. So given this, here's my question to you. How can we work with drivers to make them more aware of the challenges and improve the amount of caution and patience that drivers show based on this information? Okay. We've got our volunteer running around.
I think the first thing
we'll get the microphone to you next.
This is Frank from San Leandro. The first thing that needs to be incorporated into the campaign is a visual that captures the sense of what a visually impaired person experiences when crossing a street. Obviously, because of the range of visual disabilities, you can't cover everything, but if you have a picture, maybe from the viewpoint of the pedestrian, that shows an extremely, extremely foggy image where you clearly cannot see what's on the opposite side of the street. You cannot see the opposite corner. Any vehicles in the picture are blurs. You incorporate that with the message that you're giving about what a blind person is doing in order to prepare for a crossing, I think that's going to make it much more powerful, because most people who are most sighted individuals are going to relate to it most emotionally at a visual level.
Okay, that's very helpful. I'm taking notes.
And I think to continue on this point too, I think using ITB would be a good good tool to use, because you can break down like different ways of how the visually impaired person crosses the street or how they think. And I think it would educate the public, doing that.
Okay.
I'd just like to add, just from the other point of view, we had, about 10 years ago, a blind woman was killed in our community crossing a street, and the woman that hit her, I don't know if it was ordered or if she just did it on her own, and that's when they still had driver's ed classes going around. She went to the different high schools and did a talk mm-hmm. to the driver's ed classes about what it was like hitting a person and, the result of it and how she lives with it on a daily basis. So kind of taking it a little bit away from what is it like for a blind person to cross the street, what is it like from a driver point of view that has hit a blind person? That kind of a message might be effective also.
Very powerful stuff. Yeah, that's good.
I have a question. Have you done any work in statistics in terms of cars on the road and broken them out into like 16 to 18 or 16 to 24, 24 to 38, et cetera, so that you have some idea of the various classes and the age groups. Driver that you're going to appeal to, if you're going to do a media campaign, your appeal to, let's say, a driver over 65 should be totally different than it would be to a kid of 18.
You are absolutely correct. And in fact, there are two. So this was our first shot out the door. This It's Up to All of Us campaign was our first shot out the door this last week, last spring. This just launched in like April. We have some additional funding this coming year, and what we're going to be doing is a couple things. One, doing some targeted messaging around the older adult population. They are at very high risk, and there's no specific messaging to protect that population. The other one is distracted walking.
We're starting what?
Distracted walking. So we know about distracted driving. It's when you're on your cell phone or you're playing with your little electronics. I now have a car that has electronics. Now I understand what they're talking about when they really say, we got to watch out for all the technology we're putting into cars now. But distracted walking is me walking around, looking at my iPod, looking at my music, crossing the street with my headphones blasting so I can't hear or see what's going on, and that we have a lot of young people, especially around college campuses and schools, who are getting into collisions because they're just not paying attention anymore. And in a lot of cases, the drivers, you know, the pedestrian, because they're distracted, is not behaving in a normal way, in a way that we might expect a pedestrian to behave. So in a lot of cases, this has ended up not being the driver's fault. So I don't think I totally answered your question, but, you know, there are specific populations that do need, the messages have to be tailored to the to address the issues of that population. So yeah, we totally agree with that. We've got a hand in the front.
My name is Cam Schur, and I live on the Monterey Peninsula. I'm a member at large. Years and years ago, when I drove a car, I had to read a book on the laws regarding driving. And at that time, there was a law that you yield to a pedestrian at a crosswalk. Is that still the law?
That is still the law.
It's still, and it's also in the driver's handbook. It's still there.
And when I took the driver's exam, there was a question on it. And it's, you know, you had to answer that question. Now, it is the law. Can we emphasize that? I don't know.
You know, it's a real frustration because, you know, that is the law. And it's, I don't know if I would say it's something as simple as it's broken all the time, but it's so complex. And when you have mid-block crossings in particular, and Jean, you mentioned that, that's a real danger. We did a training down in Fresno. And we always try and do a drive around the day before the training so we get an idea of kind of what the hot, we have them tell us where are the hot spots where people are getting hit. And Fresno has a whole bunch of six lane roads. These are roads, these aren't freeways or highways. These are roads, six lanes, three ways one way, three ways the other way, where you have to go over a quarter mile before you find a crosswalk. And so, yeah, people are getting hit and killed in Fresno as a result. We had an incident in Sacramento, a very, very difficult time for a school in Sacramento, where a young girl was in the crosswalk. It's what we call a double threat, or sometimes even a triple threat, where the first car stops. They see the pedestrian in the crosswalk, they stop. The second car doesn't see the pedestrian because they're blocked by the car, right? And so they continue forward, as opposed to going, oh, that car is stopped, there must be a reason, let me slow down. And so this young girl at West Campus High School was hit and killed. And as a result, I mean, there were some positive things that came out of it. The school mobilized. They got a whole bunch more, or they are in the process of getting a bunch more, you know, kind of lighting in the site, in the crosswalk and stuff that, you know, works. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes these things happen after the fact. But yeah, if everyone just obeyed the law, we on a lot of things, we'd probably be in better shape, and you are right.
Can you have a campaign emphasizing it is the law?
I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely a thought. It's definitely a thought.
Holly, as the mic's getting to the next person, I just want to ask a question. And I know probably when putting together a campaign, it's best to be focused, but do you see, is that some of these strategies can not just be limited to motors, but to the issue we have with bicyclists, who are sometimes even more hazardous for us, that because of the high speed, they don't yield the right of way, don't tell you about it, that they're coming, and the quiet cars? It's just, is that, would that be getting too broad, or can you have parallel campaigns that shooting for, like, the bicyclists and the motorists?
Absolutely. And in fact, a couple of our trainings, particularly I think it was in Santa Clara County, we had a huge contingent of bicyclists that were there. And so we actually set up two separate tables for them. There was almost 20 of them. Two separate tables, and we did separate scenarios, because all our scenarios group work are around pedestrian collisions. And so we set up some scenarios around bikes getting hit by cars. But then this whole other discussion arose about bicyclists hitting pedestrians. And so, yeah, there's, and so they there representing the cycling community said, yeah, we do have some cyclists that are irresponsible. We don't like to say that we're all that way, but we do have some that are a bit reckless. And they'll acknowledge that. And they'll say, yeah, we need to educate those folks on how to, you know, they're driving, you know, we always say that that car is a weapon that you're driving, but that cyclist going, you know, 3 miles an hour, that can really hurt. So, yeah.
And so we could, okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a person who's been twice hit by bicyclists and ended up laying in a cast for 8 weeks I'm glad to hear that.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. It has to be targeted because, you know, a lot of the cycling community is responsible, has responsible behavior. So you kind of want to make sure, you know, you hit the whole community, but you want to make sure that that message somehow is reaching that person that has less responsible behavior.
True.
Exactly. Yep. But let's get back. I really do want to get back to my question about, are there specific ways or messages to raise the awareness of the driver about the challenges that you folks face when you're out there? Yep.
This is Charlene Ornelas with the Borough Club, and one of the things that I would like to see happening, and I'm trying to talk the San Diego police into it, they have sting operations, as they call them, all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go buy liquor for a youth and, you know, you get nailed. I'm not saying for the police, for me to just take chances at crossing the street. I don't care who you are. I'm not going to do that. What I would like to do is have police available to ask or pass out at least a warning with the information on it or an actual citation for them. Because that's where some people catch on. When they, you know, the seatbelts didn't get anywhere until they raised the fine for it. And then it became not worth getting the ticket. And the same with disabled parking. When they finally raised it high enough, it wasn't worth getting the ticket to be convenient. They quit doing it.
Mm-hmm. I think the Sacramento, Holly, you know, but I believe last year the Sacramento PD did a sting operation with an officer appearing to be blind trying to cross scene and having people not yielding. And there was another officer down the road. They got the word to go and get them, you know, and I believe it was Sacramento last year.
Yeah, they're being done more often now. And we actually have a mini grant program. We give out small amounts of money, less than $5,000, to community organizations, public health departments, law enforcement, schools, to do kind of the It's Up to All of Us campaign work in whatever way they want to do it. And I think it was Moreno Valley Police Department did pedestrian stings, and it was amazing. It was amazing how many citations they I think it was 43 citations in like 6 hours. Yeah, crazy, totally crazy.
This is Teddy Ramhild again. I have a question. An issue that's come up in my city of Burbank is about the tactile strips that they put on the ramps, mm-hmm. curb ramps,
mm-hmm.
and they're putting them all over the city of Burbank, I forget the correct name, but anyway, they're these strips, yellow, bright yellow.
I think we call them rumble. No, the yellow, little
and they're
tiny
bumpy,
bumps.
and they're on the curb ramps on all the corners, and I've been told by Public Works that this is a federally mandated.
You're talking about detectable warnings.
Yeah, detectable warnings.
Yeah, that's federal and state.
They're federally mandated. And the thing is that they cause a problem in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. People trip over them. The strips come loose on the corners. Wheelchairs don't get a lot of benefit out of them. And if a blind person is following a tactile strip at a curb ramp, they'll end up in the middle of the intersection. So I don't understand that whole concept at all.
I think the Caltrans people can address
later. That doesn't sound like the detectable warnings, and it sounds like you're talking about a guidance system.
She's talking, I think, about the little rumble, the rumble strips that, what are they called?
No, the domes are detectable warnings. The truncated, again, they're detectable. Okay, they're not being, Teddy.
In our city, they're on every curb ramp in our city.
Teddy, that is state and federal law.
They're not beneficial.
Well, we can't get into debating that now because there is research that shows differently on that and has made a difference on lives.
So some controversy there. Which is okay. So before we leave this, because what I would like to do is, as we start designing a few more angles to our campaign this year, see what we can do in terms of coming up with some messages to raise awareness. So that's why I want to give you folks the opportunity at this point to, if there's any other thoughts. A couple people, hold on.
Okay. My name is Louis Herrera, and I'm from Los Angeles. And one of the things that I see happening more and more, especially in Los Angeles, is something that is really frustrating. And this is when a streetlight gets retrofitted. They install an APS, audible pedestrian signal. These things are installed either in the middle of the sidewalk, which makes it difficult to go on one side or the other, or if they are by the corner, in most cases the pillar is lined up with the stop line, with the lines on the street. And you know that if you're crossing in a south direction and you're on the west side of the street, if the post is to your right, you're gonna end up walking inside the crosswalk. But I'm finding out that in a lot of cases I've come so close to getting hit because I am not in the crosswalk because those posts are not placed where they should be, which creates a real serious safety hazard. Because if we get hit, we're not in the crosswalk protected. However, this is something that could be mitigated if common sense is applied. These people are the ones that paint the lines. These are the people that maintain the traffic and lighting. Therefore, why couldn't they use common sense and make sure they line these posts up so that when we step off the curb, we are within the crosswalk area and be protected?
This gentleman here, and then we had a hand back there. You wanted, if you can just shout, she won't have to come up here.
This is Gene Lozano.
I was not aware of that.
Come to the business session, because that's not really, it's important what you're asking, but it's not really fitting into what we're trying to cover right now. Come this afternoon to the Committee on Access to Transportation Business Session, Grand Ballroom C, and we'll talk about that.
This is Margaret. I just had another idea that kind of remembered when you talked about putting your seatbelt on, was the crash dummies commercials that they used to use. And I know in our area they have the CHP rollover simulator that shows what happens if you don't put on a seatbelt. Sometimes that type of a visual, I like Frank's idea of the blurred trying to cross the street. I think that's a really good visual. I could see that as a PSA or on YouTube and, different media sources. It might be very graphic, but what about, I don't want to use humans, but a crash dummy being hit by a vehicle at the different speeds. That impressed me when you said at 20 miles an hour this happens, at 30 miles an hour this happens. I think that would be a good visual, and I would use a crash dummy, not a person, for that type of thing.
I really like that idea of tying it to the drama of 20 versus 40 miles an hour, because we don't have anything about that, and that is so critical. We tend to think about how can we prevent the collision from even happening, and that that's what we want to message to, but you're right. We also need to message to slow down so that if a collision does occur, we can't prevent it, let's at least make it not a fatality. So that's fantastic. Thank you. Okay, anything else before we move on to our next and final sort of group work here? Okay, if you guys come up with ideas, if something occurs to you, you're out there, you're walking, and you're thinking, well, this would be a good idea for a message or an ad, email me. Let me know. Gene's got my email address, and or however you want to communicate. Give me a call. He's got my contact information. Okay, my phone number is 916-322-2262. Give me a call if you've got an idea. I'd really like to hear, because I think we're going to put some resources into this year. Okay, now, I did mention to you that we were going to learn how to do what's called message mapping. And message mapping is a technique of taking a real life incident, and this is a very sort of specific way of taking that incident and building messages around it so that we can learn from an incident on how to better communicate what it is we want folks to understand. So it dissects the problem, basically. It dissects it into three parts. What do we know? What are the risks? And what's the action to be taken? Okay? So I'm going to kind of briefly read through to you a sample message map so you can kind of get the feel of how this flows, how it works, and then I'm going to read to you a scenario, a real life scenario happened in Richmond, Virginia, and we're going to kind of walk through a blank message map based on that scenario. Okay, so this is a sample one. Here's the problem. A young child was injured in a hit and run accident after school. So what do we know? We know that the condition of the child is critical. Law enforcement is investigating. Several parents and students witnessed a Toyota truck hit the child and then accelerate through the intersection and leave. Parents, teachers, and community members are very concerned about the incident and will be holding a public meeting to discuss what actions can be taken. So those are sort of the things we know. So from those supporting facts, we're going to come up with our key message about what we know. So our key message using those supporting facts is a young child was taken to the hospital after being hit by an unknown driver in front of Treeside School this afternoon. That's my talking point. Okay? So if someone says, what happened, that's what I can say what happened. That's the easy part. Now, the next two columns, what are the risks and the action to be taken, is where it gets a little more complicated and where we have to really kind of start thinking. Okay, so what are the risks? Here's our supporting facts. Drivers are seen being distracted by talking on the phone, texting, and watching for their child while ignoring the presence of other children in the area. This is right around Treeside School. Drivers consistently exceed the speed limits and act with an impatience when school drop-off and pick-up activities slow traffic flow. And our last fact, there continues to be a non-observance of school signage directing drivers to slow down, watch for pedestrians, and use caution with crosswalks and bicycle lanes. So given the supporting facts, we want to come up with our talking point again. Here's our talking point. Children in and around our community schools continue to be vulnerable to speeding and unsafe drivers. So we took our facts, we know they're speeding, and we know people aren't following the law. And so what does that do? That puts children in danger. Okay? So that's our talking point for what are the risks. Now, the last category is action to be taken. This is where that we want people around Treeside School, in that neighborhood, in that school, to do something. Okay? So here's the facts, or what we call supporting action. Pay attention to crosswalks, especially when making a right or left turn. Another supporting action, avoid distracted driving and walking. Encourage pledges. So a lot of people are taking pledges now not to drink and drive, but now they're starting to do pledges not to text while driving. Really big campaigns with high school youth right now to do pledges to not text and drive. I was glad to see a big banner in my daughter's high school the other day. Last supporting action, children are especially at risk as they may be harder to see and may react unexpectedly. Observe signage near schools and watch carefully. So taking those supporting actions, we come up with sort of, again, our talking point. Our talking point is practice shared road responsibilities. Okay? So you take apart the facts, and then you come up with your talking points. And you can do this in all kinds of environments. Like I had mentioned before, sometimes someone needs to talk to a PTA or a city council, or perhaps they have a media interview. And so you want your talking points, but you want them based on the facts and the actions. Okay, so this is what this Mesh's Map does. Question.
It's more of a comment. One of the things that I found, I went around to a bunch of elementary schools because elementary school kids are ready to accept the fact they don't know everything. By the time they get to junior high, they think they know everything. And by the time they're in high school, they know they know everything. So I went around to the elementary schools, and I talked about guide dogs, blindness, and I also brought up the white cane law. Why did I bring up the white cane law to little kids? Because I know how they work when their dad or their mom or their sibling goes through a crosswalk with a blind person there. They're really good at, you know, writing their rear ends about what they did wrong. Little kids, it's either right or wrong. They see black and white. They are not on, well, it was okay this time. They're flat out, it is or it isn't. And so if we do an education of how they can be safe and what the driver and what drivers should do to help them be safe, they will do an awful lot of teaching everybody else because they'll bug them to death.
Yeah, good point. One more other comment, and then we're going to go into our scenario and see how we can message them out. Two more comments, and then we'll do our scenario.
This sounds a bit drastic, but if you had a picture of a mother or father with a dead child in their arms asking you in the caption, could this be your child?
That's very powerful. I've somehow misplaced my page. I was taking all my notes. That's very powerful. And sometimes ideas like that, I have to share with you, it's kind of interesting because having worked 11 years in tobacco control, there was a lot of controversy about do scare tactics work. And then there was this kind of, over the last several, I don't know, half decade or so, this tendency to say, no, the data is showing scare tactics don't work. And a lot of that was because the DARE campaign, I don't know if you guys have heard of it, it was the middle school drug and alcohol and elementary school drug and alcohol prevention program. I actually did the DARE campaign for a while. Wasn't working, and so scare tactics don't work. Well, I was just at the American Public Health Association National Conference earlier this week in San Francisco and saw some cutting-edge research that whether or not scare tactics work depends on the personality of the person. If they are high efficacy and high fear, in other words, they are fearful and they are people who take action, scare tactics absolutely work on them. If there are people with very little fear and very little belief in themselves that they will take action on anything, scare tactics have no impact at all. They just go, oh, that's not really for me, or they're just exaggerating, and they rationalize themselves out of it. So scare tactics do have a place with the type of people who I work with. Okay, back there.
Okay, I think that the message you've got there outlined, I think, is certainly the primary message that you would want to get across for this scenario. If you're assuming that you're running an information campaign, and if your bandwidth of available, you know, if you have the available budget and the available bandwidth to send more than one message, then I think it would be good to provide three targeted messages. One is the message you provided, where you're sending the message to drivers, here's what happened, here's what you can learn from it as a driver. I think the second message that would be useful would be to take that same scenario and target it to children or other pedestrians and say, here's what happens, here's what you could do as a pedestrian to make yourself more safe. And the third target would be presenting to policymakers, whether that's the city council, the city planning commission, what have you, traffic safety people, and saying, here's the scenario. Here are the structural problems that set up this accident, and here's what needs to be fixed to make that accident less likely. Whether it's, for example, you know, we don't know were there trees in the neighborhood that block drivers' views. Is the school actually fairly close to a freeway off ramp where people are coming off the freeway at coming down from 65 miles an hour, and they're less than a mile away before they get past the school, and they still haven't really slowed down yet. Or, you know, is there a curve in the road? Lots of structural issues that is what policymakers need to be thinking about.
I think that's so important, because having that multi-pronged approach of it's not just one party that's responsible. You know, it is a number, it is the driver, it is the pedestrian, it is, you know, the community itself in terms of, you know, electeds and transportation organizations. And so I think you're absolutely right. You need multiple messages to target multiple groups. Okay, I'm going to read a difficult scenario to you now, and then we're going to have a little bit of a discussion of how we would message map this. And I've never done this, I have to be really honest with you, I've never done a message map orally, so we're going to be a little creative about how we do this, okay? All right. So the title of the article was Blind Pedestrian Hit Killed by Vehicles, plural. A blind pedestrian struck twice by vehicles in Bellevue Avenue, this is in Richmond, Virginia, on Monday, August 22nd, died from his injuries. Dudley Thomas Mines, Jr., 74, was crossing the 1,000 block of Bellevue with his guide dog around 9 p.m. when a car rounding the corner from Old Brook Road onto Bellevue grazed Mines with the driver's side mirror. Mines fell from the glancing blow. The driver of the car stopped to assist Mines, but could not reach him before a Ford pickup truck, also traveling from Old Brook onto Bellevue, struck Mines' guide dog and Mines as he lay in the roadway. Mines, who lived in the 1400 block of Old Brook Road, was taken to VCU Medical Center, where he later died. His guide dog was taken to a local veterinary hospital for treatment of a broken leg. The Richmond Police crash team is investigating both accidents involving Mines. No charges are pending at this time. Now, we talked about the teachable moment. If we had our messages ready, and you know, I'm making a commitment to you guys that we're going to, like I said, this year look at that as part of our campaign. Have those messages ready. Have partners in the community who can help us get the message out, whether it's media partners or organizational partners or school partners. But we have to have the message ready in advance. So part of this message mapping is what you do after, but then part of that work is what you need to do beforehand, and that's sort of the risk communication planning I was talking about. So we'll skip the first column, which is what we know, because that's sort of more for perhaps the traffic mayor or the law enforcement officer who's being asked questions by the media. That's more so what that's for. The second question, what are the risks? Now, this is a little difficult to do because we don't have a lot of details about the incident. But from the brief information I've been able to provide you, are there some outstanding risks that you think were there?
Given that the person was hit by the mirror of a car, it sounds like there are apparently some risks in that scenario with cars being careless about going into crosswalks or making turns, those sorts of things. Because, I mean, if you're walking across the street, you know, straight across the street, and cars are at all paying attention, a car is not going to be sideswiping some guy trying to walk across the street unless they're not paying attention, and usually because they're turning. Because if you see the person straight ahead of you, you're not going to be playing chicken with the person with your car. So there's obviously some messages there, you know, some issue problems there about, you know, careless behavior on the part of the driver in terms of maybe crossing, I mean, watching out for best pedestrians at turns or that sort of thing.
Okay, good observation. There's a hand up over here and there and then there.
I don't know if this is appropriate or not, but what just welled up inside of me is you can be the light for those in the dark.
Oh, my gosh, I love it.
And I just wanted to make one comment, and this happens every other day where I live. I take 3 steps off the curb on the crosswalk, and cars will speed up to get past the crosswalk before I get to the middle of it. They race me.
They do. They do. Yeah. I've seen it. Yeah. I've seen it. And I think there might be a message in that, too, about not racing to get ahead of the pedestrian. I don't have the words right now, but I think you're on to something there.
Yeah, that's kind of on the idea of...
You're on a race against life? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's good. Thank you.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking is blind man loses race to vehicle because that happens. They try to beat you, you know, and either cut in front of you or behind you so that they don't have to slow down. And I'm just waiting for the guy to crash because I'm going to sit there and laugh and wait for these.
Okay. Gene's got a comment.
Yeah. It brings a couple things. One is... that we have all had is that the education of the motorists. I don't have any slogans, but motorists, I assume this is a right turn, but the motorists looking to the left and not paying attention to the right, that often happens. But also, as was said, and I agree, is that when they do make that turn, the first vehicle, you know, goes around and there's usually an almost... seems to be a second vehicle who sees you, but wants to try to get through and not wait. And I deal with this in front of American River College every day, coming home, and it's 2 or 3 vehicles going through there. What's your hurry to? So I just have to agree with what the people are saying.
You have the sight, so look left and right.
So are you for hire? You've got quite the creative media kind of little tidbits here.
Sorry, just to add on to that.
This is great.
As a driver, you have to recognize that there are vehicles that have lower visibility than others. So at times, even when you do look left and right, if the pedestrian is right at that angle where that car is, I will not see you. Yeah. Additionally, I think as the lady in the front mentioned, if we are the light, I would definitely encourage, especially at night, if you're walking out at night, you have a guide dog. And I don't know if they make these or not, but even bikers and joggers, they encourage them to wear those strips or those flashing lights. Because in pitch black, if I see a red flashing light, that's going to catch my attention. And it's been in cases where, you know, sighted people can't see someone crossing the street, and they're wearing all black, the person crossing the street. Like, if we're going to be that light, then we need to have that light on our bodies, whether it's, I don't know, a glow stick, just something that's flashing, saying, hey, I'm crossing the street. There's no way you're going to miss me at this point.
Yeah. Yep. I saw a cyclist last night in the dark that had a flashing light. It was great.
Okay, I don't know if this is appropriate here for later today, but in a couple of the scenarios you've brought up now, I was thinking, because adding some more, you know, signage might be more of a distraction in some of these areas, but maybe right on red, or, you know, turn, what is that? You can't, no right on red? Turns, right-hand turn? Uh-huh. Sign postages for the case of the guy that got hit by 2 cars. And in some school crossing areas where I've been involved with some of those where there's a lot of, anxious parents and they're watching their kids and not all the other kids and such, probably more visible crosswalks, like with the flashing lights or other things to become a... get people's attention. A couple solutions like that, just more mechanical solutions.
Yeah, and they're low cost too. They're not expensive. Those are not expensive, so they're reasonably cost.
Okay.
Engineering, we can do. Okay, any other comments? Okay. Oh, up front.
The other one is people talk about the person that got injured and killed. That person's no longer got a problem. The family does, but they don't. But what doesn't they people talk about is what does it do to the life and the of the person who was driving at the time.
Yeah.
The damage that it does, what, that they have to carry the rest of their lives.
And that goes back to the testimonials. That one woman you said was doing the testimonials. And we've actually thought about doing something around testimonials of pedestrian, people who've been in collisions and survived. So that's something we're looking at because it's very powerful stuff. And with the internet, you can do a lot of that now. You don't have to do a big splashy campaign. You can just post them on YouTube.
Just one comment, and that it sounded like from the description that that this was a curve, not necessarily a turn at an intersection, and it may not be signalized, so that it just may be a crosswalk across an unsignalized intersection. The lighting could be poor in that area. Vegetation, as the other gentleman mentioned, could be a problem. But I think it's an opportunity for the community to bring dangerous crossing locations to the attention of the local agency, and that, you know, this was this time a person with a sight impairment, but it could have been a child, mm-hmm. It could have been anybody else crossing at that location potentially that would have been hit as well. And so it's the opportunity is greater than just for the community itself, but to use this as the moment that you can bring that to some form of action by the local agency.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Darrell Hikens. I'm the ADA chief for the ADA infrastructure program for Caltrans.
Thank you. I think he's your second speaker. Very, very helpful, knowledgeable gentleman who we know. I think that about wraps it up for us today. Again, if you do, particularly this lovely woman in the front, has any more ideas? I'm serious. You've got me really thinking of ways that, you know, we can build messages that are going to have some impact. We'd really, really would like to hear from you. Any other last comments? I want to thank Gene. It's a real honor for me to be here today. And, you know, I want to thank Gene for making this opportunity available for all of us to have this discussion today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I just had one last question. Yes. I just had one quick last question.
Yes, Frank.
Could you give us your contact information again? And I think you had a website, if you can give us the link to that website.
Thank you. My contact information, my phone is 916-322-2262. My email is Holly, Holly, dot Cisneros, Cisneros, at cdph.ca.gov. And our website is www.cdph.ca.gov/allofus. One word. Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity. Have a great day.
Okay, if everyone could, we still have some more programming, and I think you're going to hear some things you're going to be really happy to hear about. So if everyone could please be seated. Okay. As you just heard a few minutes ago, our next speaker talk a little. Darrell Hikens, who is the chief of the Caltrans's ADA infrastructure program. And is Alex here too?
No.
Okay. Okay, and Daryl is going to talk about what Caltrans is doing and some its policies, including acceptable pedestrian signals. So I'm going to turn it over to him right now. Please give him your full attention.
Thank you. I actually got it. I got one here. So we'll let you keep one to comment on my comments. All right. Thank you very much to Gene and the other folks at CCB for allowing me to kind of come and give you an update on where we're at with some of our implementation of the we refer to it as a 2010 ADA lawsuit settlement, which CCB was a plaintiff on, and also give you an update as to our grievance process that we've been working on over the last year to allow greater access to the public to provide us with input on locations that they would like to see improved. And also, I wanted to give you just a quick stat update on a new policy memorandum that we provided an update to the Northern California Conference section back in the spring on, and we would just give you an additional update here on the APS policy that we put out in the spring of this year. So I'm going to give you a quick status on it and on those three items, and then we'll open it up for kind of more of a town meeting type discussion with questions and discussion, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So let's start with kind of an update on the lawsuit settlement. As most of you know, Caltrans and they refer to it as the CDR versus the state of California, but actually it was CDR, CCB, and a couple of individual parties, as well as AARP, I believe, were plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit against Caltrans in the state of California that was initiated back in 2006. That lawsuit was settled in June of 2010, was signed in 2010. And it included, among other things, that the department agreed to spend $1.1 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars on ADA barrier removal projects over the next 30 years. And that's spread out into different amounts per year, starting at $25 million a year, and then it accelerates to $45 million a year in the last 5 years of the settlement. We've been somewhat successful so far in getting those projects out there. There were already curb ramp installation type projects that were going on already. For those of you who aren't real familiar with how public works projects get developed, it takes us, on the average, about 6 years from the identification of a project to actual construction, because of the amount of time it takes to get a project identified, get people to actually get out and investigate it, do survey work, do the environmental clearance that you need to do by right away from the adjoining property owners if we need to, design the project, put it out to bid, and have a contractor construct it. So it's not a short process, and when the lawsuit was signed, there were projects already in the pipeline. We're allowing those to go ahead and finish. At the same time, we're developing new projects to come right in behind them that fit more with the priorities identified in the lawsuit settlement. So beginning in the next year, 2 years here, you'll start to see a lot more projects that are specifically focused on responding to grievances from the community. And that's the one message that I want to get across today, and don't let me get out of here without saying this a number of times, is that we're really looking to partner with the folks at CCB and with the community in general. And the reason is, even though we were, when you're in front of the judge, you're opponents, but really we're looking for the community to be our partners in identifying the priority for areas to get this money. Because if I look at the entire state, we surveyed all of the sidewalks in the state of California that are owned and operated, or adjoin, I should say, our state highway system. We have 4,000 miles of sidewalk. we identified 30,000 non-compliant curb ramp locations. And that's just curb ramps. That's not sidewalks and driveways and signals and everything else that goes along with it. So just 30,000 non-compliant curb ramp locations. Those right there are $300 million worth of work. And then that doesn't include the work that goes into designing them and making them ready to go out for construction. So what I need from the folks here and from those of you that touch other people in your community is I need you to be involved in telling us where those locations are that you want to be fixed first. And that runs the entire gamut of everything from broken sidewalk to better crosswalks to APS, accessible pedestrian signal installations, to any other issue you run into, vegetation hanging over the sidewalk, something along those lines, driveways, traffic problems, anything along those lines. And I'll discuss a little bit the grievance intake process and how you can access that. The other thing with the settlement is that you need to be aware that accessible pedestrian signals were specifically omitted from that lawsuit. So I think at the time there was a feeling that there was going to be a separate lawsuit that was going to be filed for APS. As of this date, that hasn't occurred. However, So right now we're supposed to be spending $25 million just on the hard infrastructure, the sidewalks and the concrete work. That doesn't include APS work. So anything I do with APS, that kind of comes out of my pocket in addition to what I have to spend for the settlement agreement, which is fine. And what we've done, or what I've done since I've been there, is to add another $15 million a year. So we're up to like $5 million a year now that we're to spend. That allows us to do some of the APS work that we should be doing. And we'll talk about the APS policy that we put out that requires the new installation or the installation of APS signals and accessible signals with every new installation of a traffic signal. But remember that that's not included in the lawsuit. So whenever we talk about APS, that's kind of over and above that. We do provide an annual report to the plaintiffs, and a report goes to the office of CCB, and I'm not sure who receives that, if it's Donna or somebody else in the leadership there. But usually we'll send it to the plaintiffs' attorneys first, and then they disseminate it to the plaintiffs. That should be coming out. Our report for the what we call the 11-12 fiscal year, which runs from July of 2011 through June of 2012. That's the state fiscal year. That report should be coming out here probably in December at some time. It should be to you prior to the end of the calendar year. So if you're interested in that, I'm sure that they can make that available to you. And it's usually also available, I would say, within a month or two after that on our website, which I'll talk a little bit about also. And we try to make it and I believe it's always been in a reader-friendly format. So, if it isn't, Gene usually tells us very quickly that it's not in a reader-friendly format. So, we want to talk a little bit also, and I'll take questions a little bit later on the settlement or anything else. But I wanted to discuss quickly, we've spent the last year developing what is really starting to become a state-of-the-art grievance intake and investigation process. And we're doing this with the assistance of an outside consultant called ADA Accrediting and I forgot what the C stands for now, consultation. And they've been very good working with us and working with the complainants in particular. Caltrans and almost any local agency engineering group is very good at designing things, working with the hardscape, the engineering elements. What they're really poor at is working with people in general. So their soft skills, typically on the engineering side, aren't very good. So what we really appreciate with our consultant is the fact that they work very well with the complainants to get the information that we need from them, specific location information, specific problems in that area, identifying what's most important to them to fix, and then working towards a resolution with them and keeping the lines of communication open. Right now, our process, you can go online and enter it directly there. There's a telephone number to call if you don't want to enter it directly. You can also call my staff member, Alex Morales, who is the Caltrans ADA coordinator for the state, and he can enter it in for you also, or any one of our district ADA liaisons in our district offices throughout the state. There's 12 offices throughout the state, one in San Diego here, another one up in Santa Ana, and one in Los Angeles, as well as San Bernardino for the Southern California locations. A list of those is available on our website as well. The best way, because I don't even remember how to give you the full name on it, the best way is just to search Caltrans, and it'll bring it up. It's the general front page, and then if you go to the Contact Us component of that, it has an ADA infrastructure pull down for that. That again is supposed to be friendly, as far as giving you cues on that. That has a grievance intake form that allows you to input your information, your name, contact number, or email address. We need that contact information in order to get back to you. And then the area of your complaint, the nature of your complaint. And again, that takes both grievances and access requests, and it is just for the disabled community to use. We have other requests that come in for maintenance service requests, other things from the general public, but this one's specifically for the community to use. And this one gets a response from our folks within the maximum is 72 hours. You will get a call back or a response back. Usually it's within 24 hours. And what they will do is have a discussion with you regarding the specifics of your complaint, and then usually set up a time down the road a few weeks to meet with you in the field or to meet with you at a location to have a face-to-face. The other thing that we have going on is now we can track every single grievance statewide. We take in not only grievances from and access requests on the state system. About 25% of the complaints we get are on the local system. We forward those to the local agency, advise the complainant of who has responsibility for that location, and then we track the fact that the local agency will follow up with the complainant and resolve their complaint on that. Internally, if it's a complaint on our system, we are required to resolve that complaint within 180 days of the initiation of the complaint. And we're doing it much quicker than that, but in some cases it takes a while to find out who has responsibility for the location, what type of resolution we can actually perform there that will cure that problem that the complainant has. But right now we have one that'll put it up on Google Earth so we can show all of the locations that currently have grievances on them, as well as all the other locations where we've identified issues that are not complaints but are our transition plan items. So if anybody has questions on the intake process or the investigation process, I can answer those also. The other thing I wanted to quickly mention is that we did put out in March of this year, our traffic operations group put out a new policy which included two major items, a change to the pedestrian clearance time from the previous, I think it was 4.0 feet per second. Now they reduced that down to 3.5 feet per second for a crossing time. That's the state policy on that. And to install accessible pedestrian signal systems and pedestrian countdown timers at all signalized intersections and signalized pedestrian crossings when we do a signal replacement or enhancement at those locations. So part of the wording in here that we're still seeking to change formally required that before, even after installing all that nice new equipment, there was wording in here that said before we turn it on, we had to have a request from the community to do that. Looking at that, our group felt that was pretty ridiculous, and it was old language that had been taken from another policy. When APSs were first coming out, there was felt to be a need to educate people before we turned on a system as to how to use it. What we had to get across to our engineers was the people that use these use them everywhere else also. So we don't have to educate. That isn't really our job to educate them how to use it. We just need to turn it on. 90% of them know how to use it. Those that don't have other venues to learn how to use it, or they'll figure it out because they're relatively easy now. So the new policy, and we're making that change to, as soon as it's completed, turn it on. We don't have to have a request. And that's the one major change that Gene and some of the other folks have helped implement as part of this policy. So with that, I'm just going to kind of open it up, and do we have a handheld for the volunteer? Do I need to change mics so we have a handheld? All right. So we'll get a handheld too, so we can ask some questions here. He's just got, there we go. Oh, I think we lost our volunteer. Right here. Oh, there we go. We have a new volunteer. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay. This is Frank from San Leandro.
Yeah.
And you were mentioning earlier about how people can go to the website to submit a complaint. And you mentioned that they could call Alex also.
Correct.
Can you give us Alex's phone number?
I should be able to. Let me give it to you here. I'm going to have to actually pull it up on my phone because I don't have his phone number memorized. Unfortunately, Alex really did plan on being here today to be part of this presentation, but he had to have some surgery last week and is going to be on his back for a couple of weeks. So. Required that I step in for him here for the majority of this. All right, Alex's number, and this is his office number, is 916, that's the area code, 653-4913. And again, Alex is our statewide Caltrans ADA coordinator, so if you just have a question on something, or you have a question on how to get to something, or you have a general question policy or anything else dealing with the ADA, you can contact Alex. And we got a question up front. Frank, did that answer all your questions? All right.
This is Charlene Ornelas. I wanted to find out, is there an easy way to tell which streets, because some of the Caltrans areas jurisdiction is on city streets. Is there an easy way to figure out when I know the street by or the area by a city street name to make sure that whether or not it's a Caltrans joint or under their jurisdiction?
No. No easy way. Sorry. It's really one of those where previously our highways, you know, it was pretty easy to tell what was a highway and what was a city street. It's no longer that way. In some cases, the city streets are larger than our state highways that also go through the same town. We've got a couple of them up north that I don't know why they're still highways. We are in the process of relinquishing a lot of those highway routes that go through the middle of towns to the local agencies, and I see that as a good thing. It gives local control over that. But what I would encourage you to do is that no matter where you have an issue, is that you can go ahead and put it into the access request or the complaint form, and then we will get back to you with whether that's ours or not. If it's not ours, we will also contact the city for you, as well as letting you know who the contact at the city would be or the county would be for that.
I have a specific in that it's not there yet, but I have heard that in San Diego they want to put a roundabout on University, and I think University is a Caltrans street.
I'm not sure in San Diego.
Roundabouts are not friendly to blind people.
And believe me, we've been fighting that battle internally and externally for our constituency, letting them know that although roundabouts may serve a certain segment of the transportation community, they don't serve pedestrians very well, and they certainly don't serve pedestrians with visual impairments very well at all. There is a process that is being developed now, and it was just presented to our Disability Advisory Committee, which Jean is a part of, that they're developing a process for including roundabouts as an option in intersection control. Within that process, there's opportunity for the community to have input into the decision making of whether we're going to go with a signal, a stop sign, yield only, which basically is what a roundabout is a yield only type stop, or no stop. So there is opportunity to have input, and I encourage you to keep, you know, when you hear about an intersection going in, that you have your input in there to make sure that it has stop control, not just yield control, if that's what you want to see there. Any other questions? Yes.
Yes, this is Pam Pology. I'm from the San Gabriel Valley chapter. And I'm not sure that I'm directing my question appropriately, but maybe you could redirect me if I'm kind of out of line here. But I'm just not sure of the avenue to go, no pun intended. My question is that we have an intersection near where I reside. It's a four-corner intersection that used to have an APS, and one of the corners is a market, a grocery store, and that APS somehow became out of order and eventually disappeared. And I live right on the border of two cities. Unfortunately, this intersection is outside my city border, and I don't know of blind people that live in that city. So, of course, their council doesn't want to hear from me because I don't live in that city. But what can I do to advocate to reinstall an APS for those of us who go to that market?
Put it into us as a grievance, and we'll take it to the city.
Okay, and I could get help from somebody doing that because this is all new to me. So,
yeah, and in fact, if you want to give Alex a call on his number, he can help you through the process.
Okay, thank you so very much.
Sure. Is there any questions about the settlement or, well, I'll take anything. I was just prompting.
I'll ask a question. It might stimulate some things. Hi. One of our, a lady that was just here earlier was asking, brought up an issue that I know the task force is really concerned about. If it's a policy, Caltrans coming up with a policy that would require for each corner to be two ramps, so they're oriented to the opposite corner, so there isn't the problem, as the lady pointed out, that if you have a curb ramp at the apex, if you go down that ramp, then and you don't know where you're going into, but usually it's the middle of the intersection.
Correct.
And we're wondering if that is something the Caltrans, with the program, it doubles the amount of money because of the cost, but to see about getting that started, two ramps per corner, and that are oriented to the opposite one, so they're directional, and make it less vulnerable exposure for people in wheelchairs who go down and normally down the apex and then have to make a turn in the turn lane to find the crosswalk marking.
Right, and that's what was our policy, was the single ramp at the location prior to the development of our program in 2010. Since that time, we're pushing our design group, which handles our specifications and our guidance on that, and they have, in the last 6 months, changed their guidance to make the directional ramps the preferred alternative, which means the two ramps, one in each location, lining you up with a crosswalk. And so that, and part of it is that PROAG, which is the public right-of-way accessibility guidelines, is also going to make that the preferred choice for most locations. We're making that the one they need to go to first, and if they can't fit that in, then they need to show justification why they would go with a different setup than the two directional ramps.
Great. John Gasper and Merced. I'm wondering, we have a new intersection that's going in on a state highway, which happens to be where I live, and I'm there. And the question I have is, is it the policy of Caltrans to make absolutely sure that they put in on a new, totally new intersection that's been completely revamped, put the audible pedestrian signals on?
Yes. It is the policy now, as of March of 2012, that when those new signals go in, they shall have an APS on them. There may be specific locations, say out in a rural area with no sidewalk connections or something else, where they can ask not to put pedestrian signals on because there's no pedestrians out there really. So, but that would be an exception to the policy.
Yeah, my name is Brett Boyer. Just a quick question, something to think about for the technology-minded, maybe doing some kind of updating of GPS databases that would include some accessibility information. I don't know if any of that is really appropriate for this topic, but I just had the feeling that more and more people, blind people, are using GPS technology, and maybe if, you know, there definitely could be more information submitted, and I don't know if that's something that Caltrans does or how that works, but I just thought that there seems to be a lack of information about things like that, especially for some of these pedestrian GPS modes.
Are you talking about more like wayfinding type?
Yeah, or more detail about intersections or about ramps or if they're okay. Accessible, if they're, you know, if there's any kind of information that these GPS units can glean from that database, that okay. Point of interest kind of a thing.
I don't think we're there quite
yet. Yeah, I had a feeling it wasn't ready, yeah. But I just thought I would throw that in there.
We everything that we're providing on a database is CT Earth enabled, which is GPS coordinated. So every location that's been determined to be non-compliant currently is listed with a GPS location. Now, whether you would have that available on a handheld unit, or you could download that into a handheld unit, I'm not good enough of a technical person to be able to tell you that. But certainly that's something we can move towards.
Thank you.
Why don't they just, maybe not the full information, but when it tells you an intersection, it would be a very small alarm tone or whatever that could come up that would clue in that this is an accessible intersection? Simple like that.
And I'm sorry, could you restate that question?
Okay. It's not a question as much as it's just a suggestion. Okay. Let's say you're telling you it's going to turn on University Avenue and thus and such, to turn right, left, or you're on the sidewalk, right, and you're coming down. Suppose there was a very small, just a chime or whatever that would indicate that is an accessible intersection.
Oh, okay.
And that is the requirement now that's in effect from the Federal Highway Administration and Caltrans that the digital APS be used, and it has a locator tone. And if the devices are 10 feet or further apart, it is a rapid tick sound to let you know the walk phase. If it is less than 10 foot, then there's a voice, or if they're on the same pole, voice that distinguishes tells you what the street is and what you're crossing at. However, if you do find one of those where the RapidTick device, if you do an extended press, then it's supposed to say wait to cross such and such at such and such, so that you have that information too. And that is in the code.
Just clue this person in that that is an accessible, just one quick tone for that intersection. Then when you get there, you would be prepared to use the intersection.
Yeah, well, the locator tone's it. It is there. Your idea has been captured in the regulations.
In the GPS, not in the signal.
Okay.
She's talking about another level.
I apologize.
Right. Yeah, no, that's, and again, I think that's something kind of like the APS signals over the last 10 years have gotten, you know, leaps and bounds. I mean, it's like going from black and white television sets to 3D color television within, you know, a 10-year period for accessible pedestrian signals. So I think a lot of the local agencies have been kind of sitting back and saying everything's changing so quick, we don't want to get a bunch of stuff out there that's not going to be state of the art in 5 years. But I think now we're at a point where it's starting to level off a little bit, and the technology is good, and the equipment that's being produced is good, and it's providing the at least the basic necessary information to the user. I understand what your point is. Yes, yeah. You're taking us to the next 10 years here. So, yeah. All right. Any other questions regarding the settlement agreement, or regarding how you put in a grievance or an access request? Again, we're really pushing not to get to the level where we have grievances, and I term a grievance as I have somehow violated our infrastructure has violated some, our program have violated somebody's civil rights. I really want to be at the level where you're telling us that there's a problem, a barrier, and we go out and fix that barrier so that you don't have that as part of your daily routine or your something you have to overcome out in the infrastructure.
Yeah, there's one, Darrell. There seems to be confusion. Has Caltrans brought about the policy that requires when the detectable warrants are installed on the curb ramps that they're the federal yellow with a 70% contrast? Because it was there, and then we understood it disappeared, and we're hearing it's there now, but there's a big question mark, is it?
No, our policy has always been the federal yellow. Mm-hmm. We do allow the local agencies to request something that meets the 70% differentiation between the background and the accessible surface or the detectable surface. But they have to self-certify that requirement using with a light meter or something else that's measuring that. We strongly encourage and hold our people to the federal yellow.
Okay, and I guess then this is not just in my personal opinion, but it's the organization's opinion, its position is that it's just like any other traffic control device, there needs to be consistency and standardization, and it should be just one color everywhere, predictable. And I know aesthetics is the big issue that the locals are doing, but there's been some checking of it and finding even the charcoal brown of charcoal gray does not always produce the 70%.
Yeah,
and there's where that yellow sometimes can't do it, but it does. It's visible at all times.
Right, and you know we're fighting a double-edged, a couple of different levels. You know, one is that what it goes in as an installation with new white concrete behind it may not be what it's going to be in 2 years once it's been tracked over and gotten dirty and weathered and everything else. And so there's probably going to have to be a follow-up investigation of areas where they were allowed in the past to not use the federal yellow to make sure that it's still in compliance if it's not. And then we also have a problem with the federal yellow materials still on some manufacturers that aren't holding up over an extended period of time where we would like to get at least 10 years worth of use out of it before sure. We have to go back and replace them, because a lot of those are poured into the actual ramp themselves as part of the installation, not bolted on or adhered to the surface.
And let me ask this other thing, is to avoid maybe grievances or anything. I just recently was in the Northeast, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, and I've heard reports from Minnesota and Washington State that on the highways, and of course these states don't have the big wide highways we have, there's maybe four lanes, the biggest, but you'll find along the road sometimes a sign will tell you quarter mile crossing for a blind person, or it says blind person crossing. And actually motorists then, we found it, my wife and I, when we were traveling, motorists start, when they see that sign, they start looking near to see if there's a blind person crossing around the road. It's just like as if they were jaywalking. It's like sometimes you have a sign, moose crossing or deer or something like that. Yeah. I was wondering, does Caltrans have that built in for the rural areas where somebody can make such a request?
No, what we have, I think, only as a standard sign is a pedestrian crossing sign, and so it warns you of a pedestrian crossing. I guess my feeling would be, if I was to look at that in the same way as my APS policy, I expect that I have a person with sight impairment crossing at every intersection, and I don't want to have a blind person crossing sign at every intersection. So I
This is like
that's kind of unusual,
where actually, you mean me talking about a few miles,
in the rural area. More of a rural area type
and
thing.
Trying to make a crossing there, that would be the equivalent to jaywalking.
Yeah, and I can see it in a unsignalized or a non-stop type crossing, where you're just trying to warn them that there may be somebody here that doesn't see you approaching.
Yeah, apparently in this case, these situations where somebody just lives there and is trying to get to the opposite side of the road.
Right.
So, okay.
Got a question?
Yes, I have a question. I live in San Jose, but I live kind of like on the border between San Jose and Campbell.
Yes.
And with the subject that you guys were just discussing right now about the detectable ramps, it was yellow and it changed to kind of like a light red.
Yeah, brick. They have a brick red. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So what is the standards on that? I mean, is that the city? Do I need to get a hold of the city? Or,
well,
since I don't know where, you know.
I'm not sure what the California Building Code requires for folks other than us, because we kind of set our own standard with the federal yellow on that. I believe they just require the detectable surface and don't require the federal yellow, but I could be absolutely wrong on that.
You're correct.
Okay. I think there's an opportunity with the current update of the California Building Code to make that a federal yellow if there was enough opinion to override the local. Again, it's mostly coming from the locals that they want that color to match some of the other things they have going on and aren't necessarily looking at the user as being the one determining what works best for them. But if you have a specific situation and you don't think it meets that 70%, you can put it in as a complaint through our system. Yes.
My name is Bernice Kandarian. I'm the president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. And red is one of the colors that is least seen by people with low vision. So we need to do something to make it so that they don't use a color that can't be seen by the majority of people with low vision.
And that's kind of the message we try to get across from when we get an opportunity to comment. We try to encourage the locals to use our guidance in that, but they aren't required to. On their own streets, they are when they are on our system. But I'll certainly take that back also as a comment from your organization that we may call on both CCB and your group to provide some input on that if we have the chance to get before the state architect on this. All right. Was there anything else, Gene, that you think we should cover here that's come up in our meetings recently? Or maybe I'll just give you a quick idea of what our Disability Advisory Committee is, you know, how we're trying to implement that, I guess. We feel that it's a best practice to, it's not required by the lawsuit, but we feel it's a best practice to have a Disability Advisory Committee as part of our program to get input from a wide variety of the community on policies, priorities, anything to do with our ADA program. Right now we have a six-member panel. That includes representatives from pedestrian safety community, some other advocates from the Bay Area. Gene represents CCB. CDR is represented on it. Independent living centers represented on it. So we're trying to reach out. We're going to double the size of that over the next year and actually seat our first full advisory committee. And that committee is kind of our sounding board for proposed policy changes, you know, what projects, you know, what types of projects should we do first. We don't go to them with specific projects usually, but they also bring ideas to the committee, to our attention when we have things like separated bike paths and multi-use trails and roundabouts and all those good topics that we like to discuss a lot. So those are a constant point of discussion for us. So if anybody ever has any comments, please get what you would like to bring either to Alex, who's Alex Morales, who's the ADA coordinator who facilitates that group, or to Gene directly, and he can bring it to us. And that's one reason for having a CCB representative on that committee, is to be your contact to that committee, as well as for him to communicate information back to you. And one thing I'll ask, do you guys put out a regular newsletter? Or
yeah, we have a quarterly journal.
Okay. We'll try to make sure we also have our grievance web-based contact in there, as well as Alex's contact number in there in the next newsletter, as well as reoccurring every so often, so that you can find it if you ever want to get a hold of them.
Good.
All right. Thank you very much. And again, if you have any questions, you can get a hold of me directly through the website, or you can get a hold of me through Gene.
Thank you. Let's give Daryl a hand. Very much.
Sure.
Good to see you again.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Is there anything? Well, we just got a few minutes, and I know you're all eager to get up and going. But I just was hoping. There's no issue or anything, but just to kind of get your sense on things. We were talking about the federal yellow on the detectable warnings on curb ramps, and right now it is not on the in the building code as a requirement for that. It is for boarding platforms or we have flush transitions from the sidewalk into the street. And it can be argued that a curb ramp has a vehicular way. But as you, like Donna Sanchez brought up about some places they've had the federal yellow and then they've gone to other colors. And then as the decision is, if you bring it up, what do you do about the existing ramps? And I'm just wondering, because we're going to be working on a resolution on federal yellow this conference. It was, and it's the California Consultants with Low Vision have initiated this. But one question would be, if you had a local community that, let's say, is putting in red or black, and previously had yellow, And they decide, okay, well, what do you think should be done? Should it be pushing that all of them be Federal Yellow and that they should retrofit the existing ramps? Or should be that all new construction be Federal Yellow and that they should make at least a 70% contrast with the existing colors, if it's black or red or blue, and it should be, I should have backtracked, that the contrast is critical in for all of them, that you have the Federal Yellow with the 70% for new construction. I'm just trying to get a direction, so I'm confusing you. Let me start again. First option is that all existing and new ones put in be made to be Federal Yellow with 70% contrast. Second option is that the new ones being installed are yellow with a 70% contrast, and that the existing ones of all different colors, black, red, whatever, be made to have a 70% contrast. Or the third one, that all new construction be yellow with 70% contrast, and that they don't have to do anything about the pre-existing ramps. Is there just kind of a sense from the low vision community that's still here? And I know you're just opinions right now, just ideas.
So, Gene, this is Roger.
Uh-huh.
This is not exactly an answer to your question, but sitting here listening to this and listening to it over the past few days and so forth, it occurs to me that when you're thinking about, when you're measuring contrast, now someone said that they use a light meter to measure contrast.
Yes, spectrometers.
So that probably, the meter that they use probably has some calibration in it that represents the normal eye. So that, because contrast is only meaningful in terms of how the eye responds to a particular wavelength of light or whatever. And this whole thing about red, for example, it's meaningless if a light meter shows that it's 70% contrast, if it's a wavelength of light that people's eyes don't respond to, which red quite often is. So the idea behind yellow, Federal Yellow, is that it's at the very peak of most people's response curve of their eye, and just doing 70% contrast assumes that your eye has the normal range of light sensitivity over wavelengths, which is not always true for low vision people.
Excellent, Roger.
And Gene, I guess I should have said to the gentleman earlier that the reason most people with low vision cannot see red is that it's void of black. And on the other end of the continuum, green is the most saturated color with black, and therefore does not, you know, jump out at a person like the Federal Yellow does.
Any other opinions?
Yes, thank you.
Is there a way to get a mic to you?
I got it. Thanks.
Oh, okay.
The second option you proposed I would go with, but with one other proviso, that in the event that a crosswalk or a piece of construction is being refurbished, at that point, if it is not Federal Yellow, it be turned into Federal Yellow as part of the refurbishing. Other than that, I would go with the second option, because it's going to be tough enough to get this argument through given everybody's cash-strapped status. So let's say don't go back and redo everything you just finished, but in the future when it comes up for repairs, an all new one should be Federal Yellow.
Good. I think Donna Sanchez.
The question I have is that can't they just spray over the colors with yellow until it comes to a point when it needs to be changed, and then they do it correctly?
Maintenance is the big issue. The paints don't often hold up. And that's why the codes say integral. In other words, it's supposed to be the colors all the way through. And there's some manufacturers just put like a coating on top, and beneath it is white or something color, whatever the material is, and then it gets scraped or anything, and it peels off or fades, things like that. So they don't hold up as a maintenance issue, which probably in the long run is cheaper just to replace it.
Okay, well,
not a bad idea.
Because the brick color that I was talking to you about,
yes,
it was black. Well, they spray painted it, because when they spray painted it, it went out beyond what it was.
Hmm.
So that's what they did.
Okay. Yeah, I'm good. Anyone else?
Yes. Gene, the other part of the truncated domes is that my understanding was that the ramp should have them in line, and the staggered ones are supposed to be at trolley or at train tracks. And I'm seeing the staggered ones in ramps. I'm seeing, you get a variety, and consistency is really important.
Okay.
So they need to make sure that it's like in line if it's a ramp, and if it's to indicate a platform edge, that it's the staggered.
Okay, here's what's happening, and it's a good point, Charlene. The code right now, currently, both federal and state, is in line. It's staggered. And the federal government strongly encourages for the last several years using inline. What is right now, the Title 24 that's gone through a 45-day comment period that I was speaking about earlier, beginning of this at 9 o'clock, is requiring that if it were to pass, that all detectable warnings would be in line, regardless where they would be, just to ease the mobility devices to go through it. We've also gotten it where the feds are want ranges, but we've been able to get them to specify the widest spacing, 2.35-inch center-to-center spacing, which means fewer domes, and it is easier for a person with high heels to walk on. It's easier for a mobility device to go through, but there still will be some bumpiness to it. So it is going in line. That is being proposed and should be supported. I don't know anyone, even industry, that is opposing it, but that is the direction, in line, yes. Any other questions or thoughts about the federal yellow, the options? Okay.
Gene, this is Daryl. Just one more thing I want to bring up is that we've had quite a bit of input from different members of the community about the need to use verbal signage when we're doing sidewalk closures, speak out signage, but it isn't a requirement in either the California MUTCD or in any other federal or state guidance at this time. And I think the community needs to be vocal on asking for that to be a standard for any time we close a sidewalk, that in addition to the normal signage that goes along, that we have either motion detection, speak out message there, or some human being that's a flagger there that provides that information to the users that's a closed area.
Thank you for pointing that out. And that is, we've had EMCO, like one of the manufacturers, show that at a few conventions. And that's something we need to talk further about. And something that's been brought to our attention, and then we'll wrap it up, and we really would like to get your feedback. The committee, the ADA Task Force Committee for Caltrans, heard about this in a recent phone meeting, and that was that in San Francisco and Long Beach, and it may exist elsewhere, what are called cycle tracks or bicycle tracks. And I hope I'm using the correct term. But it seems to be where you have basically, you know, right now, currently, you have a bicycle lane, you know, you have automobile traffic lane, let's say left or right, so in the automobile traffic, and then it would be a bicycle lane going to the right, then a parking, on-street parking, and then a pedestrian way, the sidewalk. Well, they are experimenting where they reverse it so that you have reverse the bicycle lane and the on-street parking. So the on-street parking, well, the bicycle lane now is placed between the on-street parking and the pedestrian area. So if you get out of your car as a passenger vehicle, you basically will have a few feet, and then you step right into a bicycle lane, then you cross it to get onto the pedestrian or sidewalk. And apparently some places in San Francisco, they've started that, and Long Beach. I haven't heard anyone said from the disability community anything positive about it, but if you find that that's being tested in your community, let's hear about the positive as well as the negative things about it, because that is something that we probably will be asked to take some kind of position in the future. So thank you very much, and I appreciate you all coming this morning, and I hope that you will utilize a lot of the information you gained, and have a good day, and see you this afternoon.